Good morning again. Court calls United States versus Bradley, please.
May it please the court, Major Jeff Lee moves to the appellant, Seaman Willie Bradley. Court Commissioner Advocate requests 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The first issue here simply deals with whether or not the lower court was bound by this court's Bradley 1 providency ruling. It was not. And I set the problem up in this way. In Bradley 1, this court only determined that the application of waiver to the disqualification issue did not make appellant's pleas improvident, where one, there was no IAC claim, and two, there was only a possibility that Seaman Bradley thought the issue was preserved. For substantial changes on remand.
Is that what we held? Didn't we hold that the entry of a general plea of guilty waived it all as a matter of law?
Waived the disqualification issue.
Waived the disqualification issue, also waived the Castigar issue, which isn't an issue now.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. That the entry of an unconditional plea of guilty, and counsel said this is an unconditional plea of guilty, waived it all.
We agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so the point here is that, going with that characterization of the court's holding, which we certainly don't disagree with, Your Honor, on remand there were substantial changes. That is, there was the IAC claim raised by the appellant, which only became an issue once this court applied waiver. And second, he explained to the lower court that he did indeed believe that the disqualification issue was preserved despite his unconditional pleas, and he explained why. Under these substantially changed circumstances, the lower court was not bound, that is, by this court's previous decision in terms of the plea not being improvident. Put differently, the court was required to look at whether or not the plea was provident. They failed to do so, and that was error. This really is the thrust of our argument on issue one. If there are no questions, I'll move to the second, third issue.
Well, go ahead. Move to the second issue.
The second and third issue are really intertwined as they both relate to the IAC claim here. The second issue deals with the deficiency in performance, and the third issue with the resulting prejudice.
Okay. How is it deficient performance?
Deficient for two.
No, go. How is it deficient performance to guess wrong as to the outcome of a potential appeal? How does that plumb the depths that you need to plumb to get to Strickland?
Well, we respectfully disagree that he was guessing wrong about what was going to happen on appeal.
When this case came up here the first time,
yes, Your Honor,
we held it was waived, even though neither side really argued that. Given that background, how is this IAC at all?
Well, it's
IAC. Leave prejudice out of it. How is it IAC at all?
Yes, Your Honor. First, we would point to the principles announced in United States versus Smith. And I said this aspect of it in this way. First, he was wrong. And he was wrong on a material factor that Seaman Bradley used making his decision whether or not to plead guilty. That is, whether or not this was preserved. And in Smith, this court said that ignorance of the law and a material factor in a guilty plea cannot be a prevailing legal norm in the military justice system. And that is the Strickland rule, that whether or not it was reasonable because he fell below prevailing legal norms. That's the first aspect. The second part is United States versus Cornelius. This really lays out a blueprint for how this this case should have come down on remand. Here, like in Cornelius, the defense counsel had a means to preserve this issue despite which was conditional pleas. And he neither attempted to negotiate that plea, nor did he inform his client of that fact. This is what Cornelius Court said was deficient performance in their circumstances. And then the third issue, when we roll right into it, is that under Cornelius, we have a blueprint for the prejudice. That is, because of this disqualification issue, as the lower court found in Bradley 1, was erroneously denied by the military judge, they set aside the findings and the sentence. That is, had this issue been preserved, he would have prevailed on appeal. That's the prejudice in this case.
How do we know that?
No, what, Your Honor?
How do we know he would have prevailed on appeal?
Well, because right now, only one court has made a determination as to whether the military judge erred in denying the motion to disqualify trial counsel. That's the lower court. And they did that in Bradley 1, came up to this court and backed down undisturbed. So as of right now, we know that he would have prevailed.
Well, let's say that he would have prevailed.
Yes, Your Honor.
On his prosecutor disqualification motion, ultimately.
At the lower court, Your Honor?
Well, at any juncture here.
Yes, Your Honor.
That, I mean, his position or his argument now is that had he known that this, that his unconditional appeal waived this, that I'm assuming he would have either tried to negotiate a conditional plea, which
right.
the government could or could not agree to, so that's a bit speculative, or he could plead not guilty.
Yes, sir.
If he pled not guilty, then the government would get a, if in fact they knocked off this earlier prosecutor, they'd get another prosecutor. So don't we then look to see what the strength of the government's case is to determine ultimately if he was going to be prejudiced?
Well, then we get into, we go back to Caspigar, in a sense, Your Honor, and the government's case and was weak without the immunized testimony or the immunized statements they used from the accused. We have to remember, and I think that, as this court is well aware, initially Stephen Bradley told NCIS he had nothing to do with the shooting. He got out of the car when Townsend loaded his weapon. Then, under the grant of immunity, he tells Keaton during these five different interrogations or interviews that, yes, he shot, but he didn't intend to hurt anyone. He only did it because Townsend was waving his weapon around and ordering him to shoot. Lieutenant Keaton recognizing that he couldn't plead guilty under the PTA that they had entered into because there was a potential duress defense here, is now advising Seaman Bradley to go talk to his counsel, say, you can't plead properly. He then fires his, or releases his civilian defense counsel, hires a new one, enters not guilty pleas. Only then does Lieutenant Keaton come on the case. And when we're talking about the strength of the government's case, we have Townsend, who has Townsend, Griffith, and Brown are all easily impeachable. Townsend was put in jail, in essence, by Bradley's testimony. Brown and Griffith, who initially said that there was it was self-defense, their defense counsel sat in and watched Bradley testify in Townsend's case, went back to their clients and reported what he had said, and now they're entering PTAs to testify against Bradley. So they all have a motive to go against him. So the government's case, without Bradley's, without the benefit of the testimony they got because the immunized statements of Bradley, is weak. And that's what this
can case we was. Look at the fact, as we did in Bradley 1.
Yes, Your Honor.
This started out as an attempted murder case.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, that's pretty serious offense.
To be sure.
And he got himself, he was laboring under the benefit of a very, very favorable PTA. Now you're saying he's going
to
throw that out the window and plead not guilty?
To be sure, Your Honor. And the question is not really here whether or not Seaman Bradley was guilty. It's whether or not.
No. That's not the question. Is he going to toss his very, very favorable PTA out the window and plead not guilty and say, well, the government's case is so weak, you know? Is
yes,
he going to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
I doubt it.
Well, sorry. No,
go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We would say yes, Your Honor, and for this reason.
Well, whose decision is it to do that?
It's his decision, Your Honor. And he's in a position to require the government, well, he's in a position to exercise his constitutional right to require the government to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and to do it in a court-martial process which is fair. That is, without this infected prosecutor who had tainted really everything, because it's difficult to bring Townsend, Brown, and Griffith in to testify, because under Caspigar, which if he's pleading not guilty actually it survives appeal, are all tainted because he used that immunized testimony to refresh their recollections of events. They probably wouldn't even be able to testify. Now, that's speculative. We haven't gotten there, and that's what procedurally this case is very complex and muddy. But at the end of the day, the three straightforward issues are the privacy aspect. Second, the fact that under United States versus Smith, under Cornelius, there was deficient performance here. And third, that the lower courts, at least at this stage, of finding that there was prejudice is still the law of the case.
The lower court's finding on prejudice, that was in the first hearing,
right? It was.
The decision, and that was set aside by this court.
It was, Your Honor, but it was on the basis of the waiver. It wasn't on the
Was it partially set aside, or was it? Either we set aside the opinion or we didn't.
You did, Your Honor, but what was set aside was the lower court's ability to second guess this court on the application of waiver, not whether or not there was prejudice.
Counsel, let's assume that there's law of the case that's not going to bind the lower court in this. What do you use the lower court's initial decision for with respect to an argument on prejudice in this case?
Factual findings, Your Honor. Which we will say that as we compare the case from Bradley 1 and in this court's decision, the lower court's and this court's Bradley 1 decision, the lower court in Bradley 1 found that it was a material, or Seaman Bradley, decision to plead guilty under the misunderstanding that this issue was preserved was a material factor. And in Bradley 1, this court didn't find that that was an arbitrary or capricious finding of fact. So from our perspective, that still survives, and the lower court would be bound by it at this point.
Let's assume that they're not bound by it. What impact, if any, does that have on our decision with respect to whether the error, assuming we find error on the Strickland prong, is prejudicial?
None, Your Honor.
Counsel, let's go back to issue one, if we can. In this case, the court specified an issue on waiver.
Yes, Your Honor.
And ultimately ruled and disposed of the case on that it was the issue on prosecutorial disqualification had been waived.
Yes, Your Honor.
But then the court went ahead and ruled on the providence of the plea as well. I don't know whether we had to do that, but we did it, and it's there. And then the court remanded it back to the CCA for an Article 66 further review, which appears at this juncture to be a further review for Article 66 purposes for sentencing. How then can the CCA reopen the case?
Well, they can reopen it. We argue, first let me say that they can reopen it because they had substantially different evidence, Your Honor, and that was the sworn declaration by Seaman Bradley. That's substantially different evidence because it's the exact evidence referenced, or it addresses the very issue that this court brought up in his Bradley 1 decision. That is, there's only a possibility that he thought that this issue was preserved. So it goes right to the heart of the issue, in our opinion.
Does this have to be new evidence, or can it be evidence, facts that they had at the initial proceeding, the initial trial, but didn't bring out? The newly discovered evidence rule, does it have to be new, or can it just be facts that existed but weren't raised?
Certainly that evidence existed, Your Honor, but it would be, I think, intellectually disingenuous to say that he needed to bring it then when the issue that we're talking about here wasn't ripe. It wasn't in front of anyone.
Now, so where did we ask him to do any of this? We asked him to complete the Article 66 review. We didn't ask him to do any of what they did.
Well,
I understand that some of the separate opinions might have been construed to ask them to do what they did, but the majority opinion asked them to complete the Article 66 review.
Yes, Your Honor, but as we read the majority opinion, what it found that the plea was not improper. Now, I guess we can say that is.
I thought that we found that it was an unconditional waiver and that it was a problem plea. That was pretty clearly stated.
True.
I'm not asking you to agree with me, but I'm just saying that was my recollection of the opinion.
Yeah, I just never addressed an issue like this, Your Honor. I just haven't seen a case from this court where the concurring and dissenting opinion are telling a lower court, or at least suggesting and direct ways that they need to do something and if the majority is disagreeing without addressing that. From our perspective, had the majority thought that the lower court could not reach this privacy issue, it would have said so.
Counsel, let's assume that the separate opinions didn't exist in this case. It was a unanimous opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
What in the opinion of the court limits the court below to reviewing only for sentence?
Nothing.
What in the opinion of the court below limits the court from reviewing the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Nothing.
And what in the opinion of the court would preclude the court below from determining that if there was ineffective assistance of counsel, then under the standards of Padilla against Kentucky and related cases, the issue of providency would have to be considered in that light?
Nothing.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, judges of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Sam Moore, along with Colonel Grubegger. I represent the United States in this case. This court should affirm the lower court's decision for three reasons. First, the lower court properly applied law of the case and found that Holmes' pleas were not improvident. Second, appellant cannot show Strickland deficiency. And third, appellant cannot show Strickland prejudice. First, with the law of the case, appellant tries to recharacterize what the majority holding said in this case in its previous ruling. This court did not say there's a possibility out there, go determine which way, you know, what the actual facts were. What the court said is clear. It said the possibility that he thought the issue relating to the disqualification of trial counsel would be preserved in the face of an unconditional guilty plea does not render that plea improvident. There's no more clear way for this court to say that to the lower court. As a result, in line with the law of the case doctrine, the lower court properly found that the issue was waived and that waiver did not make the plea improvident.
So is it your view that the majority opinion of this court was that, assuming that counsel gave legally deficient advice with respect to waiver, that would have no impact on the providency of the plea?
It would, Your Honor, only to the extent that it's ineffective assistance of counsel. As this court said, ineffective assistance of counsel was not raised previously, so there was no law of the case on that.
So doesn't that allow the lower court then to consider ineffective assistance of counsel and then determine if counsel was ineffective, which I know you're not conceding, then determine whether it affected the providency of the plea from that perspective?
Yes, Your Honor, the court did just that. So the court was bound by this court's either waiver, you know, unlike what everyone is saying, there is waiver, and that the waiver itself did not make the plea.
My question may not have been clear because I think you were agreeing with something that I didn't ask. If the lower court was able to look at the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel under this court's opinion in Bradley, then the purpose of that would be for what? Why would this court allow the lower court to look at ineffective assistance of counsel?
Ineffective assistance of counsel, in line with the Supreme Court's decisions, does affect and can affect the knowing and voluntary nature of the plea.
So then why was it not permissible for the lower court to look at ineffective assistance of counsel, determine that counsel was ineffective, and then on that basis determine that the plea was improvident? I'm not asking you to agree that it was either ineffective or that it was improvident, but would that not have been within the power of the lower court?
It was, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And that's exactly what the court did. They said on the waiver issue, in line with what this court said, the waiver itself does not make the plea improvident, but looking beyond that to other issues that were not handled by this court, which was the ineffective assistance of counsel, they could and they did consider that. And they rightfully found that there is no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. As a result, the waiver did not make it improvident. There is no ineffective assistance of counsel. There is no other claim that would impugn the
right. But last question, then. As a matter of law, would it not be within the power of this court to determine then that the advice was legally defective under Strickland Prog 1 and prejudicial under Strickland Prog 2. Not asking you to agree that it was, but that's within our power.
Yes, that is before this court at this time.
Thank you.
The law of the case issue is on the waiver and on that waiver itself does not make the plea improvident.
Yeah. Just to get the facts straight, the CCA, in fact, found that there was not deficient performance, did they not?
Correct, Your Honor.
So they didn't need to reach prejudice. They said while he was erroneous, it did not reach the Strickland level of deficient performance.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. In no way did the lower court say we are bound by this court's opinion on the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Correct? Well, we didn't have an opinion on the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Exactly.
But what they said was that it didn't reach the Strickland level of deficiency.
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you agree that we can review that?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. It's just that decision was correct. Not only was there no Strickland deficiency, there's no Strickland prejudice. But the law of the case issues on the first...
The waiver issue.
The waiver issue, and that the waiver itself does not make the plea improvident. I'm not trying to muddy that water, but they're two separate issues. I understand that both go to providency ultimately. But one is just the waiver itself, does that make it improvident? And second is... Does the IAC claim the ineffective assistance of counsel claim? Does that affect the providency?
And what basis in law would one advise a client that the issue would be preserved in this case after an entry of guilty plea? If counsel sat down and thought about it, what would be the basis for that counsel advising a client that under the circumstances of this case, the issue would be preserved?
Well, that advice was erroneous. It was wrong. But it was not strictly deficient in terms of it was not to the extent that it was not operating as a counsel in the Sixth Amendment.
Well, it was wrong, but under what theory might it have been arguable or right? What basis would the counsel have had for even thinking that under the rules for courts martial and the precedents of this court that there would be a basis for raising that issue on appeal after the entry of the guilty plea?
There's certain issues that this court throughout the years have held survives a guilty plea. One issue, Ms. Gall, was a 2005 case from this court. In this court, which is right after this plea in this case, so it's the same time. Although Ms. Gall is in Article 10 context, this court says we have not been consistent in our application of waiver. So in a similar vein, the civilian defense counsel in this case may have believed this issue may survive this unconditional guilty plea. That would be one basis where he was wrong. It was waived against the plea, but it was not unreasonably wrong to the extent that he was not operating as counsel.
And did the government get a affidavit from the defense counsel in this case to advise the court as to what the basis for the advice was here?
Not from where I'm from.
So what's the basis for speculation in this case? If the government hasn't sought to introduce anything from defense counsel on here, why should we proceed on the assumption that the advice was wrong and there was no basis for it?
The advice was wrong based on this court's if I don't understand the question, I apologize, Your Honor, but the advice was wrong based on this court's opinion, but at the time and under the circumstances, under the state of the law, and which was borne out by the argument by both appellate counsels in front of this court last time, it was not unreasonable. So it was wrong, but he was operating as counsel. Nonetheless, this court can go straight to the Strickland prejudice prong if it wants to, which is there's certainly no Strickland prejudice in this case. Appellate would ask this court to follow one of the service court's opinions on prejudice, Cornelius, which is a different context, but prejudice in a guilty plea context is clear. You have to show that it's a rational decision for the appellant to have pled not guilty under the circumstances if they'd been advised correctly. Here, if the appellants have been told this issue will not survive, appellant bears the burden of showing that he would have pled not guilty as a result, which is both subjective, which is shown in his affidavit, which is cursory, but he does say the words. But it's also an objective test, as the Supreme Court has held, and as this court has held, that it's a rational question, an objective question in a sense. Here, in light of the evidence, in light of the charges against him, the other three co-accused were all lined up to testify against the appellant. One had already been to trial and pled not guilty. The other shooter received 10 years. The other, who was not a shooter at all, received 42 months based on a guilty plea. Here, when he is one of the shooters, he looked at the facts against him, the evidence against him, he looked at the charges, he looked at his options, and he reasonably pled guilty, knowing that this issue, the identity of the trial counsel, would not be preserved, would not have changed that. The identity of the trial counsel is largely irrelevant. It would not have changed the facts that he was facing and the evidence against him. In addition, he received substantial protection under the pretrial agreement. As a result, it was a rational decision.
Prejudice isn't whether to have the government put to the test of proving that before members. As long as he's really guilty, it doesn't matter what form determines that.
But Your Honor, prejudice under in line with Hill is, in a guilty plea context, is if he had been advised correctly, would that have changed his, would a rational accused under these circumstances have changed his plea? Example would be if there's a major piece of evidence, such as confession, that is the key to the government's case, and if the defense loses that motion, and now the case has changed, that might affect whether to plead guilty. That's a major issue. But the identity of the trial counsel alone, and we're not even talking about what evidence is against him, is not going to change his decision.
But your argument is, because the evidence is overwhelming, a rational person would have always decided to plead guilty. No rational person would ever want to take an overwhelming case to a member's trial.
No, Your Honor. But a rational person under these circumstances, the reasonable probability would be, based on the issue we're discussing, once again, we're not talking about a major evidentiary issue or some other major changes to the case. Based on the issue he's facing and the circumstances, he would have still pled guilty. It would have been irrational under these circumstances alone for him to have pled not guilty.
Would a rational person jettison a very favorable pretrial agreement in a case with facts like this and basically say, I'll take my chances with members?
It would not. There's no reasonable probability, not a rational person. Because once again, the issue we're discussing is the identity of the trial counsel, not what evidence is he going to be facing. Is the big confession or some big piece of evidence going to come in against him? We're just talking about who is the trial counsel going to be sitting in that chair, not what evidence the accused is facing in the trial. As a result, the law of the case issue settled the waiver and the issue of does that affect the promise of the plea. And then the separate question, which was not before this court, and which the court below rightfully considered, which was the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Appellant cannot bear that burden to show either Strickland deficiency or Strickland prejudice. Both of these issues, both law of the case and ineffective assistance of counsel, affect the judicial interest and finality of the plea, particularly in a guilty plea context. Here, since the law of the case was appropriately followed, and since appellant cannot show Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel, the government asks that this court bring this case to finality, bring this litigation to an end, and affirm the lower court's decision. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Opportunity for rebuttal.
Honors, I just have one point on the efficiency aspect of the second issue. In Bradley 1, the majority here found that it is clear the unconditional pleas were entered. And yet the strained logic of the lower court in finding that there was deficiency here disagrees with that. It said the lower court found that there was no deficiency because the D.C. reasonably thought he was entering conditional pleas. And what they actually quoting from their case is the military judge expressed his approval by accepting the plea, and the trial counsel manifested the government's tacit consent by standing mute and not otherwise.
Are objective. You quoting from the lower court's first opinion or the second? That was the first opinion, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor, this is the second opinion.
Okay. They did find an imputed conditional plea in the first
one. In the first one, yes, Your Honor.
Right.
And then they finished that quote by saying, the trial counsel did not object to the appellant's so-called conditional pleas. That is, their entire reasoning for finding that there was no deficiency here is that the defense counsel reasonably thought the conditional pleas were being allowed. And yet this majority opinion of this court found that it's clear that that didn't happen. Under this reasoning, we think the court should reject that finding by the lower court. If there are no questions on that, that concludes our rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and the court stands in recess until further order of the court.
court stands adjourned for further.